Now, the book of Daniel, what is it really about? For many Seventh-day Adventists, particularly evangelists, it's one of the keystones, the cornerstones in the Bible. Daniel chapter 2, for instance, the dream of the enormous idol constructed of different materials, is often introduced early in an evangelistic series. It's used kind of as proof that our God is omniscient and omnipotent. In other words, all-knowing and all-powerful. And there are, of course, other stories. We generally think of them kind of as kid stories, you know, like the three Hebrews in the fiery furnace, or Daniel in the lion's den. And then there are the prophecies, containing the descriptions of strange beasts, cryptic numbers, odd imagery. Is this what the book of Daniel is all about? You know, kid stories that, with what appears to be obvious morals, strange visions and dreams by kings and a prophet, and prophecies that we are supposed to figure out and understand? Or is there something more foundational? Is there a single theme that ties all these different elements of Daniel together? And take a look at chapter 1. Now, there are no visions, no dreams, no prophecies. Isn't it just a story? A historical prologue, the rest of the book? Is it just an introduction to frame the setting, to introduce the actors that would follow? It doesn't seem to share much else with the rest of the book, or does it? And if so, what is it? Over the past year or so, as I've been reading through the Bible, I've been arriving at a certain grand theme that permeates all of Scripture. Yes, you know, there are commonly mentioned grand themes of the Bible, like God's love for us, or God's revelation about Him to us, or perhaps God's plan and act to save humans from sin and death. And they're all true, and I don't want to diminish that. But the one particular theme that I keep seeing is that of worship. Now, when we hear worship, our minds often picture sitting in a church, you know, just like we are here today, in some kind of religious service that usually includes some type of preaching or teaching. Or perhaps a family getting together to read the Bible and pray. Or perhaps a group getting together to sing. Or even perhaps our times of personal meditation. Again, I'm not saying these aren't worship, but is worship just about things we do? Or is there something more fundamental? Recently, I've come to see worship in a somewhat different light. And here it is. The heart of worship is our communion with God. As we see, as we learn, as we experience God's love, as we learn about His characters as it's revealed to us, and as we receive assurance of our salvation because of Jesus, our natural response is to draw close to God and seek to commune with Him. The book of Revelation tells us that the issue to be decided at the end of time is that of worship. The question that will be answered by every person is, who or what is my object of worship? That is, in essence, the issue of the first great commandment. Do I love God with all of my heart? And then in Matthew, Jesus tells us that those who claim to be His followers, those who say they follow God, those who claim obedience to the first commandment to love God with all your heart, that they will be judged by whether or not they obey the second great commandment of loving others as oneself, of selflessly becoming a servant to others. The true object of my worship, then, is revealed to myself and to the world in the manner in which I respond to the stimuli and stresses of this world. In all the things that I encounter daily, do I sense the presence of God and respond accordingly, or do I lose sight of God and respond in a self-centered way? My response then is, in a very real sense, worship of either God or myself. And all this that I've been saying is a roundabout way of saying that, for me, the book of Daniel is all about worship. About what it means to follow God in a secular or pagan environment. And also about how all through history, worshiping the true God comes with trials and temptations to give in to an easier way. It's been said that the stories of Daniel illustrate the prophecies. The prophecies tell us that following God is never easy. The stories give us examples of people that have stayed faithful in spite of trials and difficulties that they experienced. Thus, I believe that even in chapter 1 of Daniel, the main issue is worship. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were born in the vicinity of Jerusalem some 2,600 years ago. For many generations, the Hebrews had been attracted to the foreign idols. The northern kingdom of Israel had been conquered and obliterated by the Assyrians, sometime earlier because of their failure to worship the true God. Although the southern kingdom of Judah had remained, it was far from the glory days. It had been reduced to just a few cities and towns, and the kingdom was under tribute to a more powerful kingdom. More recently, that kingdom that had been receiving tribute had been Egypt. But even Egypt had fallen to a new power coming from the northeast, the Babylonians. The kingdom of Judah never willingly paid tribute to anyone, even when their prophets told them that it was God's will that they should. More than one king had chosen to rebel, and had in turn suffered the consequences of their rebellion. It was on one such occasion when Jehoiakim was king of Judah that Nebuchadnezzar, son of Nabopolassar, came to Jerusalem and defeated Jehoiakim, taking spoils from the temple and the palace, and taking away a number of hostages, among which were Daniel and three other Hebrews, who would play then a prominent part in Babylon in the days to come. Nebuchadnezzar had gone on south to pursue the fleeing Egyptians, but received word that his father had suddenly died, and so in order to secure his throne, Nebuchadnezzar quickly made his way back to Babylon. Meanwhile, Daniel and the other three had been selected, along with some others, to be educated in the Babylonian schools for 3 years. They may have been as young as 12, and most likely no older than around 18. Old enough to be fairly independent, but young enough to still be molded in the Babylonian way. And at the right age when they would likely be questioning their childhood teachings and values. A period of testing the boundaries. It is in this setting that we read the story of Daniel chapter 1. Let's start at the beginning of the chapter and read from there. We won't read the whole chapter, but we'll read probably, go through the first 8 verses and talk about them. During the 3rd year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave him victory over King Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects from the temple of God. So Nebuchadnezzar took them back to the land of Babylonia and placed them in the treasure house of his God. The objects in the temple were dedicated and considered holy to Yahweh, the temple in Jerusalem. They were, in the people's minds, a means of holding communion with their God. So when a foreign power serving other gods took away the sacred items of the conquered and put them inside the temple of the victor, it symbolized and meant that the gods of the victor, the Babylonian gods, were stronger than the god or the gods of the defeated, in this case, Yahweh, the God of Israel. That was the mindset of the people of the ancient Middle East, and to a large degree was also the Hebrew mindset. So it wouldn't be surprising if many of the Hebrews chose to abandon Yahweh for the Babylonian gods. After all, Yahweh had been defeated, or at least that's how it looked. Here I see an introduction to how the prophecies of Daniel could be important in an environment permeated with this type of mindset. Does a person worship God only when that God is directly benefiting the worshiper? Or does a person worship God even when God appears weak or absent? Do we worship God based on present circumstances? Or do we worship God even when the present isn't so good, but we look forward to the future? Verse 3. Then the king ordered Aspenaz, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. Select only strong, healthy, and good-looking young men, he said. Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning, are gifted with knowledge and good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and literature of Babylon. The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for 3 years, and then they would enter the royal service. The young men selected were to go through three rigorous years of learning. They were to learn the language and literature of the Babylonians. One commentary says this about their schooling, quote, "That educational program probably included the study of agriculture, architecture, astrology, astronomy, law, mathematics, and the difficult Akkadian language," end quote. What we notice there in that list is that there was no religious instruction concerning the gods of the Babylonians. But likely all the subjects touched upon religious and spiritual matters. Their minds didn't separate into two separate compartments, what was religious and what was secular, like we tend to do today. Rather, all of life was considered religious. The book of Leviticus strongly implies this view of life for the Israelites, that they too had this view of life, that all of life was, in a sense, religious. And I would add that that concept of life, where there is really no distinction between religious and the secular, is a more biblical concept than what we typically operate under today. Anyway, to make sure that these young men would have no excuses or complaints, they were given the finest that Babylon had to offer. They were given food and drink directly from the king's table. This was the food of the gods. The gods of Babylon had given their approval of these foods. Verses 6 and 7. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. The chief of staff renamed them with these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belteshazzar. Hananiah was called Shadrach. Mishael was called Meshach. Azariah was called Abednego. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These names all contain fragments of either El, meaning God, or Yahweh, the personal name of Israel's God. But their names were changed to Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, names containing fragments of the Babylonian God's names. The likely intention was that they would come to associate their new life in Babylon with the Babylonian gods, and to signify to all, including them, whenever their names were spoken or whenever they thought about these names, that they now belonged to the Babylonian gods. For Daniel and the three Hebrews, everything about their new life in Babylon had religious overtones. Pagan and idolatrous religious overtones. What does a follower of the true God do when he or she is thrown into an environment that is completely foreign and even antagonistic to the true God? Notice what Daniel doesn't do. He doesn't speak out about their course of study, even when it involves subject matter and practices that probably included astrology and divination. He doesn't speak out about their names being changed, even though it meant that they would now be identified with the Babylonian gods. So the question is, how much must a follower of God accommodate things in the environment and culture that go against his or her beliefs? Where does a follower of God draw the line at working with the culture? For Daniel, the answer was food and drink. From our modern perspective, it seems almost ludicrous that someone would stake their lives on the issue of food and drink. Even if we don't agree with the extreme positions taken by some Christians, doesn't it make more sense to battle the over-secularization of public schools? Doesn't it make more sense to battle the policies that bar display of religion in public places? Daniel faced similar issues, but he writes nothing about them. Would you chance losing your life on not eating food that was brought out to you? It was an act of a gracious host, wanting to offer you the best. Couldn't you just pick around the most offensive portions and dilute the wine 3, 6, or 10 times like the Hebrews generally did? No, in verse 8 we read, "But Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods." For Daniel and the three Hebrews here, the food was where they drew the line. Why? Because for them, in their culture, food, drink, eating, and feasting was worship. Not only that, but in their minds, holiness or sacredness was a property or an attribute of objects, including food and drink. If food or drink was dedicated to a god, it acquired the properties of that god. And to consume it would be unacceptable. The Hebrews had this belief. It was codified, actually, in the Mosaic regulations. We see in Exodus 29, verse 37, "Purify the altar and consecrate it every day for 7 days. After that, the altar will be absolutely holy, and whatever touches it will become holy." Or Leviticus chapter 6, verses 25 to 27. "Give Aaron and his sons the following instructions regarding the sin offering. The animal given as an offering for sin is a most holy offering, and it must be slaughtered in the Lord's presence at the place where the burnt offerings are slaughtered. The priest who offers the sacrifice as a sin offering must eat his portion in a sacred place within the courtyard of the tabernacle. Anyone or anything that touches the sacrificial meat will become holy. If any of the sacrificial blood splatters on a person's clothing, the soiled garment must be washed in a sacred place." So that was during the Exodus time period. We see that during the exile, it was believed that this belief would carry on after the exile. We read in Ezekiel chapter 46:20, "He, an angel in vision, explained to Ezekiel, 'This is where the priests will cook the meat from the guilt offerings and sin offerings and bake the flour from the grain offerings into bread. They will do it here to avoid carrying the sacrifices through the outer courtyard and endangering the people by transmitting holiness to them.'" And this mindset and belief carried over into the time of the New Testament. We read in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 7, this is Paul speaking about food offered to idols. "However, not all believers know this. Some are accustomed to thinking of idols as being real. So when they eat food that has been offered to idols, they think of it as the worship of real gods, and their weak consciences are violated." We see through this and other verses in 1 Corinthians that Paul, at the time of the New Testament, no longer considers mere food or eating as an act of worship. But he concedes that some still do. Many did back then, and some, in fact, still do today. Paul did not condemn those who did. Rather, he went out of his way to accommodate those who did by not doing anything that would offend their consciences. For Daniel, food, drink, and eating was worship. It was a means through which he believed he partook in God's communion. It was a means through which he responded to God's grace to him. Thus, for Daniel, partaking of food that was dedicated and made holy to another god was not just improper, it meant turning his back on the God of Israel. It meant partaking in communion with another god, a case of spiritual adultery. For many of us familiar with this story, particularly if we've grown up as Adventists, we might have in our minds that the food was unacceptable because it was unclean. Now, I'm sure there were plenty of the king's food that was unclean, simply because of its source. In other words, unclean animals. Or because something clean was slaughtered and prepared in an unclean manner. But I challenge you to find anywhere in Daniel 1 about the food actually being unclean. It's It's called unacceptable and defiling, but it isn't called unclean. One other point to note is that older translations use the word meat rather than food. That word means food in general. It includes meat, vegetables, fruit, grains, legumes, drink, and just things you eat. So if this issue was simply about clean or unclean, Daniel should have been able to just pick out the unclean food, or pick out the clean foods and eat that. But because the food and drink are considered defiling, but not declared unclean, when I look at this passage, I believe that what Daniel is actually writing about is much more fundamental than whether or not the food was clean or unclean. I believe it is about worship, about who or what we commune with, about where we spend most of our thoughts and time, about what we choose to fill ourselves with. The food could have been technically clean and prepared appropriately, but if it had been given to the king of Babylon, it first would have had the blessings of the Babylonian gods upon it, and that would have made the food defiling. Unlike Daniel at the time he was faced with this dilemma, this dilemma that was fundamentally about worship. Now, we know the rest of the story. We know how things turn out for him. But, like Daniel, we don't know how our decisions will turn out when we have to make decisions that are challenging, that challenge our worship, about issues of worship. What trials and challenges face us today? What are our temptations? Who or what beckons us to come and worship, to commune, to spend our thoughts, time, and other resources? Is it the Lord God or something or someone else? For me, the greatest temptation right now is worry and anxiety. Whenever I succumb to it, I've made myself, my own wisdom, and my own ingenuity my God. I am effectively then trying to save myself from my problems. I am worshiping my own ability to solve problems. I'm communing with my own thoughts, my own cleverness. The God of heaven, the God of the Bible, the God that I claim to serve says, trust me. I can take care of your day-to-day needs. Don't worry about tomorrow. There's nothing you can really do about it anyway. Now, I should still plan for tomorrow, but I must not worry about tomorrow. For some other people, the issue may well be food. Not food offered to idols per se, but food itself. Or on second thought, maybe it is food offered to idols. You know, to look like a model. A person needs to diet like one. Or to become like a sports star. A person needs to eat like a pro athlete. Maybe none of us here are obsessed with food, but there are plenty of people in this world that are. Food, for many, is a means of reaching an obsessive goal, or in other words, an idol. An obsessive goal is an idol. To look like a model, to be like a sports star. By becoming like them, the people are in fact desiring a communion experience with their idols, just like the ancients did with their idols. For some others, it may be clothing, to look like a Hollywood celebrity, by dressing like when a person experiences communion with the celebrity. For others, it may be status. Maybe it's someone a person knows that operates in a higher social or political circle. By doing the right things, by purchasing the required items, by offering the right sacrifices to the right causes and people, a person can enter into that higher social or political circle and commune with his or her gods in that circle. Even good things can become idols. Again, food. A person can become so obsessed with diet and health that it becomes the center of their lives, their worship, their communion. They become zealous for their new religion and their God, and forget the real God that is above all of it. Or even spiritual disciplines. Spiritual disciplines like meditation, quiet time, prayer, or anything else are a means to help people draw closer to God so that in turn, they, the people, can be servants to the people around them. But if the spiritual disciplines consume so much time and resources that it becomes an end in itself, it too has become an idol, and the practitioner is useless to everyone else. You may have heard this saying before, if you want to know where your heart is, look in your checkbook, in your planner. If worship is understood primarily as communion with the object of worship, then how and where we spend our resources, whether it's time, money, or anything else that we have, is a good indicator of the true object of our worship. The most important question for each of us today and every day is, who or what is the object of my worship? Everything else in life will follow out of the answer to that question.